Osho, Take It Easy, Volume 2, Talks on Zen Buddhism, Discourse Number 11, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India.
The first question. Why, what is a natural Buddhist like me doing, leading Sufi dancing, and a natural Sufi like Pradipa doing, leading Vipassana and Zazen? Anita, this is a crazy place to be. I know it. The day I talked about the natural Sufi and the natural Buddhist, I had looked in Anita's eyes and the question was there. And I had looked in Pradipa's eyes too and she was also bewildered. Meditation has to go beyond all form. Sufi or Buddhist. In the beginning, a form is needed. And it is good to move naturally, whatsoever fits with your inborn qualities. But finally, one has to go beyond the form. Otherwise, the form itself becomes a bondage. At the ultimate point, one is not to be a Buddhist or a Sufi. At that point, one simply is. With no form, with no identity, a pure nothing. Knowingly, I have given Anita the work that she is doing here. She is a natural Buddhist. That's true. I am taking her out of her natural form. Doing Sufi work, slowly, slowly, she will slip out of her past. Her past has been Buddhist. It is easier for her to be a Buddhist. And so is the case with Pradipa. It would be easier for her to be in Sufi work. Her past interest has been there. Her deepest involvement is with Sufi ideas, particularly Gurdjieff. And I have given her the Buddhist work to lead Vipassana, Zazen. This is just a device to bring you out of your routine forms. A device to help you to go into pure meditation. Pure meditation is simply meditation. How it can be Sufi, how it can be Buddhist. On the way, you may be Sufis, Buddhists, yogis, tantrikas, but when you have arrived, all paths disappear. Then you are at the same space. In the same space. That space is nirvana. Being with me, many things will look puzzling to you. Because there are so many people at different stages of their growth. For one, I will suggest one thing. For another, I will suggest another. Whatsoever is needed at your stage of growth will be given to you. And when the need is no more there, it will be taken away. The last thing to be taken away is the form of the meditation. Then one is simply meditative. Then it is no more an activity, but just a quality, a fragrance. The form of the meditation is still part of the mind. A natural Buddhist means the mind is still there, because only the mind can be a natural Buddhist. Only a mind can be a Sufi or a Buddhist. Mind needs forms. Mind needs occupations. Mind is always hankering for some occupation. Without occupation, the mind starts dying. It needs perpetual work. Just for 3-4 days, I was not here. And people had started disappearing. Just to sit here for 1 hour was difficult. Hearing that I am not coming, Big Prem immediately left. Rakesh left. Even Divya. The day I came, Divya was not in her place. She was sitting there far away. She was sitting there with the idea that if I don't come, she can slip out easily. Just to sit for 1 hour silently doing nothing becomes so difficult. Mind is constantly hankering for some occupation. Sufism is one kind of occupation, Buddhism another, and there are millions. When I say a born Sufi, I mean your mind is in tune with Sufism. But one has to go beyond the mind, Anita. And that's the work I have given to you. It is against your mind. It is just the polar opposite. And the polar opposite will help to destroy the pattern. Once the pattern is destroyed, then one is available, easily flexible, fluid. That fluidity is meditation. So whatsoever I say to you, do it. Many times it may look contradictory to my other statements. But don't be worried about that. If I have said, then there must be something in it. I may not have made it clear to you. Because sometimes it is absolutely necessary that the thing should not be made clear to you. If it is made clear, your mind starts taking grip of it. Many things have to be left unclear, vague. Many things have to be simply done, out of your trust and surrender, not out of your intellectual comprehension of them. Naturally, Anita must have become puzzled. Why? Sufi work has been given to her, and she is doing her work beautifully, and I am happy with her work. It is difficult for her, and sometimes the Buddhist mind creates trouble for her, but that Buddhist mind has to be dropped, because all minds have to be dropped. A ladder has to be used in the beginning, and finally renounced. Now the moment has come for Anita to renounce that ladder of Buddhism. The second question, why is modern man so neurotic? Because the modern man is for the first time becoming man. The past of humanity is not of human beings. Man has existed up to now as crowd, not as individual. Man has existed as collectivities. The individual is being born, hence the modern man is very neurotic. It is a good indication. It is a great revolution human consciousness is going through. What neurosis really is? Neurosis is an indefinite state of mind, undecided, indecisive. To be this or to be that. All outer definitions have disappeared. All props have been taken away. Your identity is very fragile. Everybody knows about it. In the past, it was very easy to answer, who am I? A Hindu, a Christian, a Mohammedan, Indian, Chinese, Tibetan, Brahmin, Sudra, white, black, man, woman. Things were clear. People knew who they are. Now it is not so clear. All those labels have disappeared. Man is standing nude with no labels. A great anxiety. And everybody has to define himself. The work of defining oneself was done by others before, parents, teachers, priests, politicians. There were authorities, infallible authorities. You could have depended easily. You were not needed to think about, meditate over things. Everything was chewed for you by others and given to you. You were spoon-fed. Now man is becoming adult, mature. You have to work out your own identity. It is not so easy. Only very intelligent people will be able to avoid neurosis. Utter intelligence will be needed to avoid neurosis. Great silence. Great capacity to go out of the mind and its traps will be needed in the future. And more it will be so. In the past, intelligence was not a great value. In fact, to be mediocre was very valuable. The mediocre was always a fit, and the talented was always an unfit. No society has ever liked in the past the people who are genius, because they create trouble. Remember Ikku saying just the other day, when a Buddha is alive, he is a nuisance. What is his nuisance? his genuine intelligence disturbs the mediocre mind. His utter intelligence disturbs the stupid people. His individuality, his freedom, his rebellion hits hard in the mind of the crowd, because the crowd does not want individuality. The crowd does not want uniqueness. The crowd simply wants to belong. It simply wants not to be responsible for anything. It wants to be part of a big crowd. So the responsibility is never on one's own. It is always somewhere else. The Pope decides. The Shankaracharya decides. The President decides. And you need not bother about it. It is not for you to ask why. You are only to do and die. The modern mind is the first glimpse of individuality, hence neurosis. All answers were fixed in the past. One was not inquired to search for answers. God was there, heaven was there, the theory of karma was there, everything was so clear-cut. You could have lived with all those formulations very easily. Now, you don't know. Nothing is any more certain. A great paralysis is happening. This paralysis either can kill humanity or can become a great transforming quantum leap. I have heard in a well-known experiment in learning theory, rats jump from a stand toward a pair of cards. There is a white card that is fixed in place. If the rats jump toward it, they fall to the ground. But if the rats jump toward the other, a black card, the card falls and the rats can eat food that the experimenter has placed behind the card. The rats easily learn which card is which. If the cards are sifted around, they learn always to jump to the black card, wherever it happens to be. But in the next stage of the experiment, the unambiguously white and unambiguously black cards are replaced by cards that successively approach a neutral gray. At some point, the grays become so similar that the reds cannot distinguish between them. They can no longer tell which card is which. In this ambiguous situation, they refuse to jump. They become sort of paralyzed, tense and neurotic. They have been puzzled, confused. This is the situation of man. A very potent situation, a very pregnant situation. If men are just rats, they will go all neurotic and they will commit suicide. But man is not just a rat. Notwithstanding what B.F. Skinner and other so-called psychologists say, man is not a rat. There is a possibility that man may take this challenge and will become more integrated. Neurosis is only in the interval. Sooner or later, man will know how to deal with it. Without authorities, without God, without Bibles and Vedas, man will fall upon one's own consciousness. man will start functioning spontaneously, moment to moment, without any ready-made answers, then the neurosis will disappear. And not only the neurosis, but the mob mind also. For the first time, there will be beauty, grandeur, dignity. In the past, man was not dignified. Yes, once in a while, a Buddha happened. Once in a while, a Christ walked on the earth. But that was only once in a while. What about the millions of people who lived and died without knowing any taste of freedom? Without knowing ever who they are. They believed they are Jews and died. They believed they are Hindus and died. They believed they are bodies and died. They never knew who really they were. They never came across the inner space. And unless you come across that inner space, you live an undignified life. You live like rats. And you will die like dogs. To be a man is risky. And what is the risk? The risk is you will have to pass through a kind of neurosis. Before you can become centered in your own being, you will have to go through a kind of uncentering. Zen people say, before you start meditating, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. When you meditate, when you go deep in meditation, mountains are no more mountains and rivers are no more rivers. But if you go on, if you persist and reach to the highest peak of meditation, then again mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. This is one of the most significant statements ever made. In the middle, everything becomes confused. This century is a century of great transformation. Either man will fall back, that too is happening. That's why Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Benito Mussolini, Mao Zedong, people like these become so important. Why? Because they are authoritative. They say, you don't know who you are, we will supply you the answers. They are infallible people. They know everything. Adolf Hitler is absolutely certain. People start falling in line with him. They start following him. Old gods have disappeared. It is very easy for Joseph Stalin or Mao Zedong to lead people. Because people cannot live without gods. People cannot live without priests. People cannot live on their own. This is the problem. So these 50 years, 60 years, man has seen two things happening. Very few people have risen towards individuality and they have become peaks like Everest. But many more have fallen back, have regressed, become fascists, communists, and there are so many brands available. And whenever a country is very, very confused, and Adolf Hitler is bound to arrive. It was not just an accident that Germany became the victim. One of the most intellectual countries in the world. The country of professors and scholars, thinkers, scientists. Why the country of so many intelligent people became a victim to this madman? The reason was that these intelligent people, professors, philosophers, could not supply the ready-made answers. They were too polite. They were too hesitant. They were too humble. They were too intelligent. They could not shout. They only whispered. And people needed slogans, not whisperings. Adolf Hitler shouted from the housetops. He was not whispering. He gave his slogans, clear-cut, well-defined. All that he gave is nonsense, but that is not the point. People are not worried about sense or nonsense. Their whole thing is they want somebody who can shout so confidently that they can follow easily without any turmoil in their being. They followed Adolf Hitler. It happens again and again in the history of man. Intelligent people follow very unintelligent leaders. And this has been a problem for psychoanalysts. Why it happens? Now just look in India. A country which has cultivated intelligence at least for 10,000 years. And following a man like Morarji Desai. This seems just unbelievable. Why it should happen? There is a reason to it. The people who think, the more they think, the more they become hesitant. They start talking in ifs and buts. They become humble. And people don't need humble statements. To the ordinary mind, a humble statement looks as if you are not certain, you don't know. That's why in India, Mahavira could not get many followers. And he was one of the most intelligent people that has ever walked on the earth. Why it happened he could not get followers? Compared to him, very ordinary people have accumulated great masses as their followers. What happened to Mahavira? The reason was he was so humble. His statements always started by perhaps. If you ask him, is there God, he will say, perhaps. But who will follow such a man? You will think he himself does not know. Perhaps, maybe. Who is going to follow this man? You ask him, is there a soul? And he says, maybe. Natural inference is that he himself does not know. The reality is just the opposite. He knows. And he knows it so deeply that only it can be expressed by a perhaps, a mayhaps. It is so vast. It will be stupid to say yes or no. It will be reducing it to a very ordinary statement. It will become political. It will not have that height and plenitude of a philosophic experience. Yes, God is, and God is not, and God is both, and God is both not. This way Mahavira used to talk. You ask one question and he will answer in seven ways. He will use all the categories of logic to answer your single question. But you will be left more puzzled than ever. You had come with one question and you will go with 7,000 questions. Who will follow this man? Adolf Hitler says in his autobiography, Mein Kampf, that there is only one difference between truth and untruth. And the difference is of repetition. If you go on repeating an untruth loudly, forcibly, it becomes true. And he experimented with the idea. And he proved the idea to millions of people. Just utter nonsense, but he will go on repeating it. And slowly, slowly, people started believing in him. People needed a leader. Nietzsche has said God is no more, but people cannot live without God. People feel very shaky. So these are the two possibilities. Either man will fall and become a victim of some kind of fascism, Nazism, communism, or the second possibility for which I am working here with you, that man may take this vagueness, which looks like neurosis, as a jumping board, and will get free of the whole past, and will take a quantum leap into the future, and will start living without leaders, and will start living without clinging, without any kind of belonging. The whole earth is yours. It is not needed to be divided. And Christ and Buddha and Krishna all are yours. You need not be a Christian or a Hindu or a Mohammedan. The whole past is yours. Use it, but don't be used by it. Use it and go ahead. Use Buddha and Christ and Krishna and Zarathustra and Laos. But don't be confined by them. You have to go ahead. There is more to life. There are still unexplored realities. The mystery is infinite. Man is in a kind of neurosis. This is a very pregnant situation. Either you fall back or you jump ahead. Don't fall back. And falling back is not going to satisfy you either. Only growth satisfies, regression never. Even if your childhood looks very, very beautiful, it is not going to satisfy you again if you become a child again. You will be miserable because you have known youth and the freedom of youth and the adventure of youth. To be a child again, in the old sense, as you were once a child, will not make you happy. You will feel reduced, not enhanced. Man is in a kind of neurosis because denied access to reality always produces insanity. By placing normal people in an abnormal situation, we get abnormal behavior. Modern man is a revving engine without clutches. Wheels are destination. All destinations are no more relevant. And man has to learn now something absolutely new, which was never known before. Man has to learn now to live in the here now. Yes, a sense of direction is needed, but not a fixed goal. A significance is needed, but not a definite meaning. A destiny is not needed. A dignity is needed. Freedom is needed. And man has to explore his freedom and decide on his own. Remember it, there is no given meaning. That's the problem. In the past, there was a given meaning. You were told the meaning of life. Now nobody is telling you what is your meaning of life. You have to create it. For the first time, man is on the verge of becoming a creator. Up to now, you have been creatures. Now you will be creators. Let this be declared. That the history is taking a turning. You are on a threshold of a new consciousness. Up to now, man has lived like a creature. God was the creator, and man was the creature. And God was the one who decided, and man was the one who followed. Now this is going to be no more the case. Now man is the creator, no more creature. Now man has to decide the meaning of his own life. He has to give significance to his own life by his own creativity. You cannot borrow it. You cannot beg it. You cannot bargain for it. You will have to create it. And this is really a problem. To create meaning needs great intelligence. To create meaning needs great awareness. To create meaning needs great endeavor. And people have learned a simple trick of begging. Somebody will give you meaning. Your father, your mother, or the great father in the skies, he will give you meaning. You have just to pray. That's why I say again and again, Buddha is going to become more and more relevant every day. As time will pass, Buddha will become more and more relevant to humanity. Buddha came 25 centuries before his time. Now is the time for him. Because he believes in freedom. He believes in individuality. He does not believe that you are creatures. He believes that you are creators. Create yourself. Give shape and form to your being. Paint your life. Sculpt yourself. Whatsoever you will be your work. It is not fate. You are responsible. And people don't want to be responsible. They are afraid of responsibility. They want somebody else to take care of them. They always need guardians. These are the people who are getting neurotic. Because guardians are no more there. In fact, they were never there. You were only believing in them. Because you believed, they were there. Now the belief has disappeared. They have disappeared. They were created by our belief. Man has to learn to live alone on his own. This is a great opportunity. Don't take it negatively, otherwise you will be in madhouses. Take it positively. Accept the challenge. And you will be the first real human beings on the face of the earth. The third question. During the lectures, you seem to bring us up to your level. You sit and talk, surrounded by Buddhas. But as soon as you leave, our egos are back again. We are the same old smugs we were before. Is the experience of what happens when we are with you just an illusion or the only reality? Satya, it depends how you interpret it. The criterion is this. If it gives you great contentment, if it takes your anxieties away from you, if it helps your mind to disappear, even for a few moments, then it is real. You will get back into your old mind again. Because when you are with me, you are not alone. You start flying with me. When you are with me, you are riding on a tidal wave. When the wave is gone, of course, you have only that which you have. The old mind starts functioning again. And naturally, 1 hour you are with me and 23 hours you are with yourself. So those 23 hours may look like the reality, just because they are long. And this 1 hour may look like illusion. It is not so. Truth does not depend on durability. Truth has nothing to do with time. If something is true, it is true whether you know it for a single moment or for your whole life. And if something is untrue, it is untrue. You can go on dreaming for eternity. It remains untrue. It is not a question how long it stays with you. Then what is the criterion? The only criterion is if it gives you bliss. If it takes you to a point where time disappears, mind disappears, where the world stops suddenly, then it is truth. Only truth can stop the world. Only truth can stop the mind. Only the impact of the truth can create the interval in you. And thoughts for a moment cease. I know. Once you are away from me, again the old mind will come in. Then be watchful. Then know that this old mind is just a habit. Watch it. Don't become identified with it. Let it be there. You remain aloof, unattached, far away. And then you will be surprised. Even without me, those moments will be coming. Once in a while, then more, then still more. The more you get unattached with your mind, the more these moments will penetrate in you. But in the beginning, it is natural to feel as if what happens with me is illusory, because it lasts only for a few moments. Two hippies feeling high are ambling slowly down the street. Another hippie walking toward them gently lifts his hand in greeting and says, "Hi," as he passes. Two blocks later, one hippie turns to the other and says, "Man, I thought he would never stop talking." It depends how you interpret. In the course of his medical examination, a man was asked to stretch his arms in front of him with the fingers of each hand extended. What the doctor saw was a terrific quivering and shaking in all directions. "Good Lord," he said, "how much do you drink?" "Hardly any at all, doctor," was the reply. "I spill most of it." Your old mind has lived with you long, for a millennia. Its grip is great. And it will supply you all kinds of explanations. Beware. Those few moments that happen here while you are with me, those moments of satsang, those moments of communion, listen to them, nourish them, cherish them, remember them again and again, chew them, digest them. They will bring you closer and closer to reality. That is the whole function of a master. To give you first tastes of the beyond. So slowly, slowly, a great appetite arises in you. The fourth question: sometimes it seems to use up more energy to say yes than to say no. This seems so strange to me. It is like saying riding the horse in the direction it is going is more difficult than holding back a river. Would you comment? Amitabh, it depends. It depends upon your desires. If you are riding on a horse, in the same direction the horse is going on its own, but deep down you have a desire to go somewhere else, then it will be hard. Because each moment you will see the horse is taking you away from your direction, from your goal. There will be great turmoil. You are on the horse, but not with the horse. You are against. You want to go somewhere else. Deep down you are saying no. Only on the surface you have said yes. Yes is never difficult. It is difficult only when it is only on the surface. And deep down is the no. Then it is difficult, very difficult, more difficult than the no. If you say no, it will not be so difficult, because it will be your natural inclination. difficulties arise only when you go against your natural inclination. Otherwise, yes is so simple. How it can be difficult? How it can be a fight? But dig a little deep, and hidden behind the facade of yes, you will find a great no. In fact, to hide that no, you have created a facade of yes. Then there is a struggle, because you are divided. And the no is coming from the deeper core, and the yes is only imposed from the outside. You will find a split. Then it is better to say yes to no, rather than creating a conflict. It is better to relax with the no, don't create conflicts, because conflicts are always harmful. They dissipate your energy. Yes is good if it can come out of your totality, root and all. Otherwise, no is good. At least it is total. Remember always, the goodness that happens through yes is because of its totality, not only because it is yes. If you can be total with your no, then it is a kind of yes. Only the formulation is in the form of the negative. But always remember that your circumference should not go against the center. If it goes against the center, sooner or later you will be tired. And the center is going to win over finally. So the whole struggle is futile. Be with the center. And if the center is wrong, and there is no necessity that the center is always right, I am not saying that. The circumference may be right. The center may be wrong. But if you are totally with the center, that very totality will make you capable to see the wrongness of it. Seeing the wrongness of it, there will be a change. Not brought by you, but on its own accord. The insight will bring the change. So this is my suggestion, Amitabh. If you feel that saying yes is difficult, then look somewhere there is great no, which is resisting, fighting with the yes. It is better to go with the no. If the no is right, then there is no problem. If the no is not right, then by going into it, you will see that it is not right. Seeing it that it is not right, it drops. And then a totally new quality of yes arises in you, which will not be imposed, cultivated, enforced in any way. It will come from the center to the circumference. Always live from the inside out, never vice versa. People are doing just the reverse. They are living from the outside towards the inside. They pay more attention to their circumference, to their conscious mind, to their intellect, to the head. Hence the difficulty. Hence people look in such anguish, continuously tired, dissipated, fighting. And there seems to be no end to this fight. The center can never be defeated by the circumference. This is an absolute law. There has never been any exception, and there will never be. So never move into a futile fight. The circumference is important against the center.
The center has all the energy. The circumference has only words. The circumference has logic, explanations, philosophies. But the center has all vitality. God is in the center. Man is in the circumference. Never put your man against the God, otherwise you will be defeated. There is no way to defeat God. Be with God if you want to be victorious. And if sometimes it is no, then let it be no. Trust it. This is what I call trust, and this is what I call yes. Say yes to the center. Even if the center is saying no, then you have to say yes to that no. And go with it. And totally. If center is right, fine. If it is not right, the very going into it will help it to disappear from your being. And then only, yes will arise. Then yes is a song, a celebration, in which the center and circumference embrace each other, dance together. When the center and the circumference dance together, there is joy. The fifth question, why do people want to be rich? When one is rich, one does not have to be smart. And that's a big relief. That's why people want to be rich. Nobody wants to be intelligent. Richness can afford to be stupid. You can see the faces of rich people. You will always find a kind of subtle stupidity. The more rich a person is, the more you will find he lives not, he vegetates. You will not find the sign in his eyes of life. People want to be rich so they can afford to be stupid. It is really a great relief. If you really want to be intelligent, who cares about being rich? If richness comes as a consequence of being intelligent, that's another matter. But who bothers about it? It is not a direct goal. And the difference is great. Intelligent people also become rich. Intelligence is real richness. Whatsoever they do, they succeed. So they become rich, but their richness has a different quality to it. They enjoy their richness. They use their richness. A person who wants just to be rich will become rich, but will not be able to use it. He will not have enough intelligence to use it. In fact, he was trying to become rich so that he need not be intelligent. If an intelligent person becomes rich, then richness opens great doors of music, of literature, of science, of art, of sculpture, of poetry. All these things become available. But the goal should not be richness. The goal should always be more life, intelligent life, abundant life. The sixth question, why do men go on living in the same old rut of misery? They don't know that there is any possibility of being blissful. They have lived so long in misery that misery is equivalent to life. They have become accustomed to it. Do you know that poor people never rebel because they become accustomed of poverty? Of course, rich people cannot rebel because all rebellion will go against them. Then who rebels? It is always the middle class people who rebel. Karl Marx, Frederick Engels, V.I. Lenin, Mao Zedong, all these people belong to the middle classes. All revolutionaries are born in the middle classes. Why? They talk about the revolution of the proletariat, but no proletariat seems to be interested in the revolution. The proletariat has become accustomed. The poor thinks this is all there is to life. He has relaxed into it. He has lived in it. He has no other taste. How can he imagine any other kind of life? The middle class person has some taste of richness and some taste of misery, poverty. He is in between. He becomes rebellious. You ask, why do men go on living in the same old rut of misery? First, they don't know that anything more is possible. They have given it up. They say, this is life. This is all there is to it. And then naturally it is better to go on living in the same old type of misery than to change it. Change brings even more misery. You become accustomed of a certain pain. If you have a headache and you have lived with headache for years, you have become accustomed with it. Would you like to change it for a stomach ache? If you think over it, you will decide it is better to have the old. At least now, I can cope with it. And who knows what the new will bring. And I will have to learn again. So people remain glued to a certain vicious circle of their misery. They go on moving in the same rut. It seems easier. And the more you become acquainted with it, the less it hurts. Thirdly, they are even afraid to drop it. Even if a chance arises to drop it, they will become very much frightened. Because it is like an old love affair. A great friendship has arisen. Now they won't know how to live without a headache. Now they won't know how to live without jealousy. All that they have known up to now has been part of their jealousy, possessiveness, anger. Now suddenly if God appears and says, I can take all your miseries away. Just think, one fine morning, you open your eyes and God is standing in your room and he says, I can take all your misery. Will you be ready to give all your miseries? You will say, just give me a little time to think over. This is so abrupt. give me a little chance. You will not be able to give immediately, because then how you will live? This is your whole script. This is your story. Without this story, you will feel very empty. And people would like to remain miserable rather than to be empty. And bliss is emptiness. Bliss happens only when you are empty. Hence, Ikku's insistence again and again that be empty, be a nothing, a nobody. There is no self, just pure emptiness. In that pure emptiness, bliss grows. Bliss blooms only in the soil of emptiness. And who is ready to live in emptiness? People like to live surrounded by junk. It feels good. You feel rich. This junk is yours. That junk is also yours. Everything is yours. Sitting in the middle of it, you are a king. Empty. Nothing to claim as mine. All empty. And great panic will arise in you. That's why people don't call their misery, misery. To call it misery creates problems. They give it different names. Somebody says it is my karma. Somebody says there must be something hidden in it, a great message from the unconscious. Somebody says fate, kismat. Somebody says God and his will. And God is wise. And if he is doing this to me, there must be a reason in it. These are explanations to decorate your misery, to make it a little soft, a little polished, sophisticated. Two hippies are standing on a corner, grooving the scene. Just then a huge safe falls from 20 stories high, crashing right behind them. "Hey, man, did you hear that? What was it?" says the first hippie. The second hippie closes his eyes, smiles serenely and says, "E flat." And that is happening every day. But you go on finding beautiful explanations. E flat. Those explanations are consolations. Your whole life is collapsing. But you go on inventing new ideas. Your whole life is nothing but wounds. But you go on covering them with beautiful flowers. Stop it. Look into the wounds as they are. Don't decorate them. If you really want to get rid of the wounds, never decorate the wounds. Look direct, immediate into the wounds. They stink. There is pus. It is horrible. It is ugly. But it has to be looked into. And leave the wounds open. Because to leave the wounds open is one of the sure ways to cure them. And don't hide your miseries. And before you can ever be able to drop your miseries, you will have to learn a few other things. First, you will have to learn to live with the new. That's what sannyas is all about. A gesture to live a new style of life. You will have to learn to live with the new, only then you can drop the old. Secondly, you will have to learn to live in emptiness. That's what meditation is all about. Only then you can drop your junk. And thirdly, you will have to live with people who are blissful, so that you can have a little whip, a taste. You will have to live in satsang. You will have to look into the eyes of someone who has arrived, so that you can have a little taste, a little sweetness enters into your being, and you can see, and you can be thrilled and stirred again, and a great longing arises in you that life is not all misery, that God too happens, that nirvana is also possible. That is the meaning of being with a master. That something of the beyond is available. If you miss, it is because of you, not because that it is not there. Live in close affinity to some window from where you can see the distant stars. Yes, they will be distant. But once you have seen, you will never be the same again. And you will have to start learning from your past experience. People never learn. People learn from books, but they never learn from their experiences. And in books, there is nothing to learn. All that is there to learn is in your experiences. Listen to this Sufi story. Mulla Nasruddin went to the market and saw a big bustle of hot chili peppers on sale. He bought them, returned home, and began to eat. A little while later, his disciples came and saw the mullah with tears streaming down his face, his mouth and tongue burning. Mullah, why do you go on eating them? As he reached for another, Nasruddin replied, I keep waiting for a sweet one. You have lived in miseries, but you are waiting for something sweet to happen. And this world is nothing but hot chilies. But you go on waiting for some sweet chili. Maybe this one or the next. You go on hoping against hope. Drop all hope. Yes, there are blissful experiences, but they are not from this so-called life that you have lived up to now. They come from the beyond. They come from a separate reality. Seventh question. Bhagwan, the other day you said that some people are born Buddhist. I must be one of them because I always feel deeply in tune when you speak on Buddha or Ikkyu. This is my natural climate. But I remember that I also felt like that when you were speaking on Jesus, yoga, Tao, Sufism. Please help me to find out which is my true nature. Sugita, you are a natural Rajneesh freak. The last question. I hear so many stories about you, all contradicting each other. Even about your philosophy, no two disciples of yours seem to agree. Why is it so? I have no philosophy at all. So how my disciples can agree on anything? I have no dogma, no creed. My assertions are not philosophic but poetic. My assertions are not about the truth. They are only devices to help you awake. To one disciple, I create one device. To another, another. How can they agree? They will agree only when both have become awakened. Their awakening will be the agreement. But when two persons are awakened, they have nothing to say. They may laugh. Their laughters may agree. Or they may cry out of joy. Their tears may agree. But statements can't agree. You must be new here. Don't be bothered by it. Because I have no philosophy, there can't be any agreement. Secondly, each disciple is personally related to me. My relationship is personal. It is not that you are following a certain philosophy. You are being with a master, not with a philosophy. While I am alive, why bother about the philosophy? Leave it for people who will come later on when I am gone. Then there will be much philosophical work, research and PhDs and D.Litts. Leave this for other stupid people. You need not bother about it. You are here with me. Quench your thirst. Why you should be asking my disciples about my philosophy? Even if you ask me, you will not find any consistency. One day I say one thing, and another day is another day. And I have no commitment with the past. When I say something today, I am not at all thinking of all the yesterdays that have passed. I am not obliged in any way to be consistent with the past. And a man who is always consistent with the past is a dead man. In fact, he should not live anymore. What is the point? If he is going to be just consistent with his past, then it is better to close his life. I am still alive. What I will say tomorrow, nobody knows, not even me. It is not decided yet. It will happen. You will be surprised by it and I will be surprised by it. I am always surprised by my own statements. And then there are more than 60,000 sannyasins now. And only very intelligent people become interested in me. This is not a place for mediocres. Only very intelligent people gather courage enough to come close to me. Sixty thousand sannyasins mean 60,000 philosophies. And each person has his own way of understanding what I am saying. And it is perfectly fine. It has to be so. How can you understand that which I am saying? You can understand only that which you are hearing. And there is bound to be a great distance. I say something from my state of consciousness, you hear from your state of consciousness. Slowly, slowly, the distance will become smaller and smaller. And one can hope one day the distance disappears. But then you will be silent. It happens. When Mahakashyapa was given the flower by Buddha as a token that whatsoever can be said has been given to others and whatsoever cannot be said, I am giving it to you, Mahakashyapa. People gathered, they asked Mahakashyapa, now tell us what happened. And he laughed. In the Buddhist scriptures, there is not a single statement made by Mahakashyapa after this. Before also he has not been mentioned. He suddenly comes to such prominence that all other Buddhist disciples just disappear. Mahakashyapa becomes the most prominent one. One fine morning, and Buddha gives him the lotus flower and says, this is transmission of the lamp. Or transfer of the message beyond the scriptures. I have given to you, Mahakashyapa, what I cannot give through words. Naturally, people were intrigued, interested. But no statement has been made by Mahakashyapa. Except a simple saying is reported. And that simple saying is this, that my master is saying it so beautifully, that what is the point of my saying it in any other way? He is doing it perfectly well. I cannot improve upon it. Whatsoever I say will be degrading it. So I will keep quiet. In old Taoist monasteries, it has been an ancient rule that say only something if you can improve upon silence. It has been written in all Taoist monasteries on the main entrance gate. Say only something if you can improve upon silence, otherwise keep quiet. What is the point of saying something if you cannot improve upon silence? So when a disciple will come very close to me, he will not have anything to say. Meanwhile, he can say many things, but they will only represent his state of consciousness. Remember always, have you read Buddhist scriptures? They always start with this statement, I have heard such. All Buddhist scriptures start with, I have heard. Why? It is a significant statement. This statement is made by Ananda, Buddha's great disciple, who recounted, when Buddha died, he recounted all the stories that Buddha said, the parables, the answers, the sermons. But he always starts by, I have heard. The meaning is that I don't know what Buddha said. I know only what I have heard. This is my statement of what I have heard. Remember, when somebody asks you what Bhagwan says, say it the way Ananda said it. Say, I have heard. Don't claim that this is what he says. The only claim, rightful claim, can be this, that this is what I have been hearing. This may be so, this may not be so. A hillbilly boy from Nashville, Tennessee, announces to his fox, I is a going to Knoxville to fetch me a wife. A few days later, he returns with a nubile young sweetheart called Mary Lou. She is introduced to all the family, cramped around the kitchen table of their tiny shack. Come 6 o'clock, his father says, well, my boy, I guess you too deserves the family bedroom now. Your ma and pa can sleep down here. So the happy couple go off upstairs. Half an hour later, a shotgun blast rattles the timbers, and then the sun clambers down slowly, the steps from above. Whatever happened? Inquired his mother. I shot her, said the son. Why? She was a virgin. The boy's grandpa, who had sat quietly through all these proceedings, was first to break the thunderstruck silence. Son, I guess you did the right thing. If she was no good to nobody in her family, then she aren't no use to any of us. Are this second story. Thor came down from Mount Olympus to find and make love to a mortal woman. He was handsome and irresistible, so in short time he found the woman and they jumped right into bed. Now he was no ordinary lover, he was God Thor. And the love making went on for a night and most of the next day. Mission accomplished, he left. But then thought perhaps he was not being fair, since he had not told the woman that she had been making love with a god. So he went back to her house and knocked on her door and said, I just thought I should tell you that I am Thor. You are Thor? She moaned, I can't even walk. Enough for today.